This is continuing coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Who's responding?
That would be me, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay.
This will be very brief. The Commonwealth, in their moving papers, Mr. Lally, I think, has gently stepped back from the moving papers a little bit. The moving papers suggest that they seek to preclude the defense from presenting any evidence to the jury that one or more of their witnesses lied or gave false information in this case in any particular. They do this under the rubric of bad character, but that misunderstands or misapprehends what character evidence actually is. Character evidence or bad character evidence refers to using past behaviors or past traits of a person to prove a propensity to act in a certain way in the future. Conversely, proving that someone lied or gave false or misleading information in regards to a specific matter that's relevant and material to the case at hand, that's called impeachment. And that's allowed in every single courtroom across
the country. So impeachment's certainly allowed, but do you intend to put on witnesses regarding challenging character evidence?
No, we're not intending to. That's exactly what I was going to summarize by saying the bad character focuses on general character traits, whereas impeachment deals with people who lied or were untruthful. We intend to do the latter.
Hold on, Mr. Lally, you're not objecting to impeachment, prior inconsistent statements, things like that?
No, of course
not. Counsel, you mentioned that there is a distinction between character evidence and straight impeachment. Character evidence is not permissible because you're not going to introduce it, you said, right?
We're not seeking to introduce it at this point, and we wouldn't. I mean, obviously, the trial has to play out, and it's going to be several weeks. And by the way, Mr. Lally has mentioned over and over and over about how he has no reports and no statements, et cetera. He's got more than 7,000 reports and statements, both from his own investigation and from the federal investigation, that in no small part encapsulates a lot of what we intend to impeach with. However, as I stand here today, I can report to the court that we don't intend at this juncture to put on bad character evidence. We don't know what that might look like. All but right. If we did, obviously I know the rules. I would give the Commonwealth due notice and the court notice before we went that direction.
All right. So 312, Mr. Clerk, is allowed. If you need to readdress that, defense counsel, you need to file a motion. Okay. So 312, Jim, is allowed. Same thing. Do you intend to put on character evidence? It's a difficult standard or potentially problematic, but do you intend to do it?
Your Honor, we at this juncture do not have intend to put on character evidence, but we will give the court notice as well as Mr. Lally notice if we do change our mind.
All right, so 313, Jim, is allowed and defendants can renew it.
I'm sorry, what's the second part? Allowed?
Defendants can renew it by written motion. How about 24? Is there an objection to that?
I believe that was 24.
No, it was 23.
I apologize. 23, we had said we had no objection.
Okay, I didn't
and
have
And 24
that.
Is the opinion or character.
Okay, so 24 is, all right.
I'm sorry.
24 is allowed, Jim. 23 and 24 are allowed. All right, there's an objection to 25, Ms. Little. Just yes
Honor,
or no.
Mr.
All right,
Jackson, so
I'm going to hear from Mr. Lally on the motion. I just wanted to know if there was an objection.
Your Honor, I could probably, if I don't mean to step on Mr. Lally's toes. If he wants to talk, he can talk. We don't anticipate asking any of our experts to read from a treatise. If that's what his concern is, and that's how I read the motion, we don't anticipate going there. That might short circuit this.
So no treatise, no studies?
They will refer to studies, not to read from studies on the witness stand at this point, at this juncture. Certainly, their studies are the foundation of every expert's testimony.
Okay, but what he's saying is he has no discovery of even who your experts are, so how's he going to read all these articles?
I understand that. As the court knows, and we anticipate, and I think Mr. Unetti is going to address this with the court soon enough, he will be getting our expert reports. We now have, finally, their final notice of what their discovery is.
Certificate of compliance.
And we are anticipating by the beginning of trial, by Tuesday, to have something in response to that. But no, we're not going to elicit an expert to sit there and read from a study or read from a treatise, if that's what their concern is.
Anything you wanted to add to this? It looks a little broader than that to me.
It is a little bit broader than that, as far as it also refers to anecdotal experiences or things of that nature, which obviously wouldn't be contained within a study or wouldn't be contained within certain materials. So I'm sure counsel is well aware, and I'm not certainly saying that they're not, as far as what an expert can testify to and what an expert cannot testify to. But essentially, what an expert can testify to is facts that they personally observe based on testing or things that they do themselves. Facts in regard to things that are in evidence or things that the counsel reasonably expects will be put into evidence. But the studies themselves, any sort of anecdotal experiences that they may have had or any sort of scientific literature is not something that is permissible to be admitted as an exhibit. So if that is something that they seek to talk about, the Commonwealth would submit that that's improper. You know, what they did in this particular case, sort of what their baseline of experience is, what their baseline as far as their educational background in order to form some sort of opinion based on the facts as the jury finds them, is certainly fine. But making any reference to because it happened in this study, it must be true in this case is something that's simply not permitted.
Okay.
If I may, just briefly.
Sure.
Mr. Lally uses the phrase anecdotal experience. That's the first time I've ever heard that in this context. I don't know what he means by that. But if what he means by that is bringing into court something that the expert has done or experienced or has experience with, and then relating that back to his opinion or her conclusion, isn't that what he's suggesting Mr. Whiffen do with his in-court experiment? That sounds like an anecdotal experience. But that's just me. I think we have to take this on a case-by-case basis and figure out what the experts are going to say. I don't know what anecdotal experience means. So I can't really defend against that because I've put hundreds, if not thousands, of experts on the stand. I don't know that I've ever asked, can you tell the jury what your anecdotal experience is with fill in the blank? So I'm not sure what he, and I'm not being glib, I just don't know what that means. So I don't know that the court can adequately rule on it. I think this may be something that we wait until
the— So let's get the list of the experts. Take a look at the Commonwealth's defendant's expert discovery to you, and you can raise it again.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Jim, let's say no action taken. All right, 27. I'll hear you, Mr. Lally.
Yes, so, Your Honor, this motion in limine is in reference to prohibiting reference to any federal investigations conducted by the U.S. Attorney's Office or the Federal Bureau of Investigations. So to this point, the U.S. Attorney's Office has publicly confirmed that at no time has the U.S. Attorney's Office named any person or entity as a target. So any sort of reference to essentially what they've stated throughout the course of, and I know the court has had a chance to review those materials, but what they state is essentially their investigation into some unnamed criminal activity or some unnamed crime or some, there's nothing specific to any specific person or entity that is contained within those materials. So what the Commonwealth is submitting is that any reference to the fact that those things occurred is therefore unfair, you know, essentially biases against one side or the other based on that, and it really has no relevancy. As far as making reference to, if counsel at some point, either side, wants to make reference to testimony or statements, reports, things of that nature that were provided in the course of that discovery pursuant to the TUI, obviously that's perfectly permissible, but it also can be done without making reference to where that item came from. As far as you testified previously in relation to some investigation on such and such a date, you spoke to a law enforcement agent on such and such a date and you said this. If it's needed for those kinds of reasons, as far as impeachment and whatever, that's obviously perfectly permissible, but any reference to that in front of the jury, Your Honor, is something that the Commonwealth would submit is simply impermissible and irrelevant to the facts as they pertain to this case. So for those reasons, the Commonwealth would ask that this motion be allowed.
Is there an objection to this?
There is. Your Honor, the Commonwealth's position can be basically summed up in their moving papers with the following sentence that they drafted. The proceeding would be unfairly prejudiced if the defendant is permitted to rely on the mere appearance or existence of a federal investigation, especially where the investigation was shaped and influenced by the defense. First of all, the defense does not and did not shape or influence any federal investigation. The federal government is more than capable, Your Honor, and I think the Commonwealth knows this, of making its own decisions and about its own investigations. Second, and just as importantly, the Commonwealth cites no authority whatsoever that stands for the proposition that the mere mention of a federal investigation prejudices state court proceedings in any way, shape, form, or fashion. And that's because there is no authority. That authority does not exist. But most importantly, and this is critical, it is going to be critical to give the trier of fact, this jury, the proper context in which every one of the statements or every bit of the evidence is presented and how it came to light. It's essential for the jury.
How are you going to do that? How do you propose? Is somebody from the U.S. Attorney's Office on your witness list to come in and talk about it?
There are federal agents. No. We don't anticipate presenting the fact that there's a federal investigation.
Isn't that what this does? If you mention it?
No. What this does.
Explain to me why that's not so.
That's what I'm doing.
Not yet, you haven't. So please explain that.
As the court knows, it's essential that the jury is given the context in which every single statement, whatever the statement might be, is brought to light.
Does that mean, do we say in the prior trial that resulted in a mistrial, you said this?
No, but you would say when you were speaking with Officer Smith or Officer Jones from the Canton Police Department at the Canton Police Station in this particular context, did you say this? When you were questioned by the Commonwealth's attorney in this proceeding, did you say this? When you were questioned by the United States attorney in this hearing, did you say that? That's what we do. Otherwise, it's perpetrating a fraud on the jury. The information that's gleaned during the federal investigation was revealed, Your Honor, importantly, by a neutral third party. A neutral body that's not connected in any way to this case. The Commonwealth has a stake in this case, very obviously. The defense certainly has a stake in this case, but the federal authorities have no stake in the case of the Commonwealth versus Karen Reed. Thus, the evidence procured by that neutral agency, which is independent of the case, is subject to a different and completely different level of scrutiny, a completely different level of assessment by the jurors. That is an important fact. There is no other way to truthfully and honestly present this evidence to the jury. Think about some of the questions that the court just posed. What were the circumstances in which you changed your testimony, sir? He's going to say, well, I changed my testimony, potentially, when I was called before a federal grand jury and I was asked questions under penalty of perjury. Why did you finally admit certain things when you were confronted with additional evidence, ma'am, and where did that evidence come from? Well, I was called before a grand jury and I was asked, or I was interviewed by a federal agent and I was asked or confronted with additional information, text messages, phone calls, etc. Or the third example, where did that additional evidence come from, officer? Text messages, phone calls, private communications. Oh, it came from a hearing in which I was questioned by a United States attorney under penalty of perjury in front of a grand jury. The jury's entitled to those answers in that context. If we were to do what Mr. Lally suggests, if we were to take that invitation, oh, well, you were asked by a prosecutor at a former hearing XYZ. That would leave the jurors with the imprimatur of the idea that the Commonwealth elicited those questions, that the Commonwealth did their job when we know, in fact, it didn't. The answers to those questions directly go to Ms. Reed's Bowdoin defense. Bowdoin talks about the inadequacy of an investigation. Obviously, Mr. Jannetty can talk more about that in just a second. We have information that a different agency was able to uncover information that the state investigation ignored. That's important. And it's important for the jurors to be able to weigh and balance that information and how the information came to light. If the truth is actually hidden from the jury, which is what the Commonwealth is asking the court to do, that the evidence was produced by was the product of a third party, the truth being that the evidence was the product of a third party inquiry, unconnected to the state court case, then that jury is left with a false impression, false information, and it'll be unable to properly assess the true facts, which is what we're trying to get to, the true facts. Why is the Commonwealth so intent on hiding the truth from this jury? I'll submit.
Okay. I'll likely rule on that today. So, number 28, Mr. Lally.
Thank you, Your Honor. So, again, similar to the motion previous to it, the Commonwealth is not seeking to hide anything from the jury. What the Commonwealth is simply seeking to do is ensure that whatever information that's provided to the jury is actual admissible and relevant information and not the product of rank speculation. So this motion is seeking to prohibit reference to any pending internal affairs investigation or unfounded allegations of misconduct. And really, primarily what we're talking about here is any sort of internal affairs investigation related to Trooper Proctor and the 20-something-year-old civil case which resulted in no findings of liability that was referenced by counsel in their motion to dismiss with reference to Sergeant Lank of the Canton Police Department. Under the case law, including McFarland and Graham, the most recent case law, what they essentially attribute is that those types of information, when there is no finding of liability, there is no sustained finding of misconduct, there is no findings of liability by the party at question, that is simply not admissible. And so for those reasons, the Commonwealth submits that this motion should also be allowed.
All right, who's arguing this for the defense? And Ms. Little, what I need to know is what exactly you intend to introduce and how you intend to introduce it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's somewhat premature for the court to rule on this issue. Obviously, the testimony of both of these witnesses is going to be highly relevant as to whether this particular information is relevant. We are still actually receiving information with regards to the internal affairs investigation as recently as yesterday. So I'm happy to kind of defer ruling to the court and then address this as it comes up. I think the court will be in a much better position to rule on this issue once the witness testifies.
All right. So what would be helpful to me, once you know what it is you think you're going to try and introduce, to tell me how that complies with the holdings in both McFarland and Graham.
There are independent reasons why that is admissible outside of McFarland and Graham.
Okay. So I need to know all of that.
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I'll take this under advisement. And how much time do you need to give me at least a general response now? Can you have it by Tuesday?
We can do that, Your Honor.
Okay. All right, so I'll hold off on that, Mr. Clerk.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So number 29, Mr. Lally.
So this motion, Your Honor, is essentially entitled Motion to Eliminate for Advance Notice if defendant intends to cross-examine any witness about alleged bias and request for a pretrial ruling on whether proposed evidence demonstrates plausible showing of alleged bias. So the Commonwealth is not stating that there are no statements, as the court is well aware, that could be interpreted to reflect bias and could be used by counsel in cross-examination. What the Commonwealth is not suggesting, and bless you, is for any prohibition on any statements whatsoever. What the Commonwealth is seeking here is a ruling as to what precise statements the defendant seeks to introduce in regard to that, so that the court can make a ruling prior to the witness testifying before the jury as to exactly what's in play and what is going to be admissible and what's going to be allowed, as far as obviously it's not a perfect world, and if a witness were to answer something in a way that would then open the door for further material to come in, that's understandable. But at least a preliminary showing as to exactly what the defendant submits are the statements they wish to introduce in relation to this issue.
Isn't the defendant given broad range in cross-examination as to bias?
Yes, and that's why I indicated early on that I understand that there is some that there certainly is some areas that under the law, whether or not they're true or not, are able to be explored as far as cross-examination is concerned. But what this motion simply seeks to address is there are restrictions to that. It's not unfettered. It's not, you know, just anything and everything that they could possibly think of or say as far as accusations go.
Is there any particular type of testimony you're concerned about? I mean, is there anything in particular that you say they should not be permitted to go into? Based on what we've heard throughout the pendency of this case, is there anything? I'm reluctant to tie the defendant's hands in any way on cross-examination without knowing exactly what it is you think is improper.
Okay. And what I would do, Your Honor, what I would suggest is similar to the other motions that we spoke of before, I can provide a supplemental with more specifics as to what the Commonwealth's concerns are.
Okay.
If the court would find that helpful.
Yes, I can't rule on this as is. So is there any objection to that, Ms. Giannetti? You're nodding.
Well, no, I think that makes sense.
Okay.
It was Ms. Little's motion.
Oh, I'm sorry. I saw you nodding.
I don't want to step on her toes.
No objection to that, Your Honor.
Okay. All right, so why don't you do that? So
certainly.
Mr. Clerk, we'll hold off on ruling on this until we get something from the Commonwealth.
Okay.
So the Commonwealth will clarify. Right, and then no action taken. All right, so as you know, third party culprit and Bowden are often argued together, often presented together. Why don't we just deal with the two motions together? So, Commonwealth's file, you're number 30 and 31, Mr. Lally. Mr. Giannetti, are you arguing both? Does it make sense to sort of keep them together?
I agree that they should be kept together.
Yeah. All right, so why don't I hear you as to your concerns on both? And as you know, sometimes third party culprit as it goes to Bowden is different than just straight third party culprit. And actually, it might save us a lot of time. Is that what you intend to do, Ms. Giannetti? Third party culprit as it goes to Bowden, or straight third party culprit as well?
Definitely third party culprit as it goes to Bowden, that's for sure. And then depending on how the evidence develops at trial, there may be, an offer to offer third-party culprit evidence with regard to third-party culprits. But I think I can speak further to that in response.
Mr. Lally, go ahead. You can argue these however you want to argue them.
No, I would argue them sort of in that vein, Your Honor. So understanding that based on the state of the evidence, as I anticipate it to be, and in any case, regardless, I think a defendant in any criminal case has a much better shot, essentially, at getting evidence in regarding to Bowden as sort of a backdoor through, as to third-party culprit as sort of a backdoor through a Bowden defense. What I'm primarily concerned with, Your Honor, is Motion to eliminate number 30, because as the court is well aware, there have been a number of theories of sort of speculation, rank speculation, opinions without any evidentiary support, names of certain people that have been dropped at this microphone by counsel at different pretrial hearings who are not witnesses, who have nothing to do with this case, who don't know anything about this case, who counsel, when they said those names and sort of dropped those whatever they supported to be facts, knew that they had nothing to say and nothing to do with this case. What I'm concerned about is whatever is acceptable as far as believability when it comes to arguing things in pretrial motions, shouting things from courthouse steps, or bandying about on Twitter is not what we do here. And so now it is a time where counsel is going to be relegated to what is actual admissible relevant evidence. And what I'm asking for in this motion is for the defendant through her counsel to actually provide any admissible or relevant evidence that pertains to third party culprit, which to this point they have not done. So if this is something that's going to be raised as an issue on its own, as the court is well aware, what the case law indicates is that the acts of the other person are so closely connected in point of time and method of operation as to cast doubt upon the identification of the defendant as a person who committed the crime. It has to be specific. It has to be to at least a specific realm of person or a specifically identified person who would have motive, opportunity to commit the act with which the defendant is charged. And up until this point, I have not seen anything specific as to that. As it pertains to the Bowdoin motion that the Commonwealth filed, what the Commonwealth is asking for there is notice and voir dire in relation to a Bowdoin defense. So if there is, again, going to be some, I don't think the evidence comes anywhere close to a Bowdoin instruction, but certainly what the courts have said over time is that a Bowdoin defense is something that, if the evidence warrants it, counsel can elicit testimony in regard to it or attempt to and make arguments in reference to it. So I'm not seeking to preclude counsel from making arguments or from counsel asking questions. What I'm seeking clarification on is what exactly, and again, this is from a position of operating without any information whatsoever as to what a defense may be. And understanding that counsel was not required to provide any information until the Commonwealth filed its certificate of compliance. But there's been, regardless of whether they were required to or not, I'm going into trial on Tuesday without any information whatsoever as to who they've spoken to, what they're in, what statements they might be, who their witnesses are, or anything of that nature. So for those reasons, the Commonwealth feels it appropriate to at least file a motion to be given notice as to exactly what the defendant intends to do. This trial by ambush is simply not something that's permitted by the case law, and that's what the Commonwealth is seeking to prohibit in that second motion. Thank you.
Okay. All right, Mr. Nandy, I'll hear you.
Thank you.
And though they're argued together, I do want you to also start with the third-party culprit alone, not third-party culprit as it goes to Bowdoin, but third-party culprit alone, because of all those factors that I told you, as you well know, the case law is clear, that I have to consider, and if I had to do it now, and you know I can do it pretrial, right? You know that I can, today I can just exclude it. I'm not inclined to do that, but I need to be able to make those decisions, to weigh those factors, because right now I have zero information on
right,
this.
I understand that, Your Honor, and that was my plan going into today anyway. So the initial question is, why is there a third-party culprit defense? Why is it relevant? And we start, Your Honor, with the fact that our forensic medical examiner, Frank Sheridan, a pathologist, forensic pathologist, who has performed himself thousands and thousands of autopsies, has already submitted a sworn affidavit to this court that John O'Keefe's injuries are consistent with having been in a fight and are not consistent with having been hit by a car. Since he submitted that affidavit, the federal authorities have provided us with their reports, whereby FBI experts also corroborate that John O'Keefe's injuries are not consistent with having been hit by a car. They employed experts in biomechanics and kinematics who have reviewed the evidence in this case, and they've confirmed that the physical evidence essentially shows and doesn't show what Dr. Sheridan has opined. So therefore, if John O'Keefe was not hit by a car, that means that Karen Reed did not kill him. And we know that John O'Keefe did not die of natural causes. This was not a heart attack or a stroke. John O'Keefe was injured. He was mortally injured. If he was not hit by a car, as both our expert and FBI confirmed, then he was attacked. And if he was not hit by a car, then there is a third-party culprit or culprits. So by asking this court to prohibit the defense from introducing evidence that others had the motive, opportunity, and the means to attack John O'Keefe, the Commonwealth is essentially asking this court to prohibit Karen Reed from being able to defend herself.
So I don't think they're asking that you be prohibited from doing that. They're asking first to have you tell them what that is.
Right. Well, this is, you know, Your Honor, I'm getting to that in terms of...
All right, go ahead. You have your remarks.
That we're either required to give them or not. You know, it is not our job to solve this case for the prosecution. It's our contention. They had the opportunity to do that, but they failed. It is not our job to name a specific third-party culprit. We do not have to prove that Brian Albert or Colin Albert or Brian Higgins or some combination of them intended to kill John O'Keefe. We don't have to prove that any of them attacked John O'Keefe such that he eventually died. They have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they didn't. But the fact of the matter is there is evidence that all three of them had a motive, had the opportunity and the means to attack John O'Keefe. Now, the Commonwealth cites Commonwealth versus Conkey in their motion, and as this court started the discussion on this issue when you first took the bench, Conkey makes clear that a defendant has a constitutional right to argue that somebody else may have committed the crime. And certainly, no, the acts of that person can't be too attenuated in time or method of operation, as Mr. Lally mentions. But in terms of being the right time period, Your Honor, you can't get any closer than their presence at the scene at the very time that John O'Keefe was killed. And in terms of the method of operation, given that we have evidence that he was not hit by a car and that he was attacked, all three of these men, either alone or in combination, possessed the ability to attack him with or without a weapon. I mean, that's a very low standard here. The Commonwealth acknowledges that. It's a low standard of simple relevance. And the evidence here establishes relevance. Now, I would note, Your Honor, the Commonwealth cites Commonwealth versus Finney. I don't know if they realize this, but that was my case. I represented Roland Douglas Finney before the Supreme Judicial Court, and I represented him at his motion for new trial and at his retrial. And that case, the Finney case, provides strong support for the introduction of third-party culprit evidence here, irrespective of a Bowdoin defense. In fact, the reason that Mr. Finney's conviction was overturned was that his trial counsel failed to pursue a third-party culprit defense. And Your Honor, the third-party culprit defense in Finney was weaker, far weaker, than the third-party culprit defense we have here. The evidence of motive in that case was that the third-party culprit made derogatory statements about the victim after she was murdered. No witness in that case put the two of them together. No witness in that case put the third-party culprit at the scene of the murder where the victim was murdered. There was some consciousness of guilt evidence, similar to what we have in this case. But in Finney, the SJC ruled that not only was that enough for a defense attorney to present a third-party culprit defense, but he was ineffective for not doing so. And as the court has also touched upon, the SJC found that on the basis of that third-party culprit evidence, which is weaker than what we have here, there were substantial connecting links between that third-party culprit that justified the admission of hearsay in that case. And I want to make it clear, we're not looking to introduce any hearsay statements, so we don't need substantial connecting links here. Now, Your Honor, I could go through with the court the specific evidence we have with regard to motive, opportunity, and means with regard to the three Commonwealth witnesses that I've named.
So go ahead.
More raw courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed is coming up from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Press subscribe so you don't miss a minute.